My name is Dr. Stephen Paget. I'm the physician in chief emeritus at Hospital for Special Surgery, and this is Conversation with Experts. This is Dr. Vivian Bykirk, who will announce her name and title.
So I'm Vivian Bykirk. I am the head of the Inflammatory Arthritis Center of Excellence here at the Hospital for Special Surgery.
So I wanted to give you a little bit of background before we talk about the role of anti-TNFs plus methotrexate versus triple therapy. An important topic for today, and go back around 50 years with regard to the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. So in the early 1950s, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories were available, and a Nobel Prize was won for the use of steroids in the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis, SLE, and rheumatic fever, but they knew very quickly that it was a double-edged sword and kind of a deal with the devil in many ways, because it was effective but had a lot of side effects. Then we used gold, penicillamine, and eventually methotrexate came in and has really had a profound effect upon the outcome of rheumatoid arthritis. And subsequently, anti-TNF medications have been developed, and now we use them in our armamentarium, and they have made an extra boost in the treatment of this inflammatory systemic disease. So today I'm going to talk with Vivian specifically about the kind of battle in some ways between the use of the combination of anti-TNF and methotrexate versus triple therapy, which includes sulfasalazine, hydroxychloroquine, and methotrexate. First, I'd like to ask Vivian to talk about what disease modification means to you in RA.
So it's a great question, Steve. The modification, I think to most people, means that the disease course, their trajectory is altered for the better, and that there will not be damage, that there will not be progression of erosions, there will not be more joint space narrowing, that function will be maintained. However, modification may mean that you actually can improve the chance of even getting into sustained remission if you treat early enough. Within 3 months, you increase your chance of getting into sustained drug-free remission.
Where do comorbidities fit into the concept of disease modification?
So I think comorbidities in two ways. One, comorbidities influence your choice of therapies in the sense of people tend to worry about comorbidities and may undertreat the patient in the wrong way because they perceive the comorbidity is a reason not to treat. And they'll use more steroids, which ironically increase comorbidities. If you think about cardiovascular comorbidities, which is a big one we worry about, if you treat the disease very effectively with our current armamentarium, you reduce the risk. You reduce the chance of having inflammatory disease of your vessels and other factors that end up in causing cardiovascular comorbidities. We tend to see most infectious risks occur in the first 3 months of treatment. Many studies show that. And then that risk goes away, which suggests that actually treating the disease reduces the risk of infections versus the medications themselves. And I think people are starting to rethink comorbidities in the concept of using therapy.
Mm-hmm. Do you think cardiovascular disease, premature cardiovascular disease, is an extra-articular manifestation of RA?
You know, the studies are starting to suggest that. So the highest risk of having a myocardial infarction in somebody who's has rheumatoid arthritis is when they were just diagnosed.
So I'd like to move on to this concept of which is the best therapy. If a patient comes in, your family member, for example, and they have had rheumatoid arthritis for 1 or 2 or 3 years, and they have been on methotrexate in full doses, either orally or subcutaneously weekly, and they're not achieving a remission by any criteria, CDI, SDI, DAS, whatever. What do you then choose, and how do you make that choice? Could you give us a little bit of an idea of how you make that choice on behalf of the patient?
I think three things come to mind. So, or four things come to mind. First of all, we still treat to target. I believe the targets should still be remission if it's possible. And there are plenty of data that show that patients who are in remission have better long-term function, have less cardiovascular disease. Overall remission is the place to go. That's first, and I explain that to the patient. The second is, what is the patient's risk tolerance? In other words, are they able to, they have to agree to what they're going to take, because if they don't agree, we can decide, but if they don't agree, they're not going to take it. So adherence and patient preference comes into play. And part of that is also what they can afford. Ideally, I would add a biologic. If they hadn't been taking methotrexate well and perhaps been underdosed but not tolerated it fine, I would probably push to methotrexate sub-Q 25 as an interim measure before adding a biologic, because sometimes that really does work. But those situations are rare because most people are taking enough methotrexate. The question is whether we should go to triple therapy before we go to a biologic. And I think I personally think the answer is no to that if the methotrexate has been appropriately maxed out. Because I don't think there are no data that have looked at sub-Q 20 to 25 methotrexate versus triple therapy, something we're looking at now. So there's, you know, the added benefit of adding sulfasalazine and hydroxychloroquine versus adding a TNF, I think there's no contest. The other issue is you're asking people to take another 6 pills a day versus one shot every once or 2 weeks, or even once a month. Again, adherence. The patient has to take it, and it, you know, no drug works if you don't use it.
So what about the cost? The cost issue comes up all the time. Insurance companies are almost defining which drug or drugs they want. There are sufficient randomized controlled trials that have appeared in major journals that support the use of triple therapy. What do you think about the cost issue? Because I would imagine that costs much less than anti-TNF and methotrexate.
You know, I don't think people have shown in long-standing disease that if you add sulfasalazine and hydroxychloroquine, that is cost-effective. Because to be cost-effective, you have to improve quality of life. And you have to improve qualities. Well, you don't improve quality of life hugely by adding 6 more pills that add another maybe 10% benefit, if you will. If you add another 30% benefit and people are now able to work, they're able to do their hobbies, they're going to report way higher quality of life, so the qualities are going to be better. It's a completely different situation in early RA. If you take someone with early RA and you optimally treat them with DMARDs, you have a 30% chance of getting them in remission very quickly. You have a 60% chance of getting them in remission by 1 year. If you were to start a biologic at the beginning, you have an 80% chance of getting them into remission at 1 year. And I think the insurance companies are willing to take that gamble and say, okay, let's just try the DMARDs first because we've got a pretty good odds of getting people into remission with just DMARDs. I think that if we treat our patients to target, and if they aren't getting a good response by the first 3 months, then we have to seriously consider altering the approach. In other words, going from triple therapy to a biologic. And I'm going to equate 25 sub-Q of methotrexate with triple therapy at this point, because I suspect they're pretty similar. So if by 3 months you haven't seen somebody drop in their CDI by 5 to 10 points or in their DAS-28 by at least 1.2, you have to wonder if they're actually going to be a responder, and at that point start thinking about a change in course.
So you brought up some interesting points about the value and who values what, okay? So if you bring into this, from a societal point of view and a personal point of view, the economics of being able to go back to work, which is not on the insurance company, but it's on society. Or you think about surgery, the need for surgery, or functional problems that somebody has. Those need to be factored into it as well, don't they?
Oh, I think so, and I actually disagree. The not going to work is on the insurance company. It's just a different department. It's siloed. So whoever is making the treatment decisions is not the person who's concerned that that person is going to be on their long-term disability
list. So you're talking
list.
About short and long-term disability as
yes.
well. I think that's a
yeah.
really good point.
And it depends on their education level. Higher education, more sedentary job, less likely to lose work. Lower education, more physical job, more likely to lose work.
So you're very much involved in rheumatoid arthritis research and have pushed the field wonderfully. Where are we going from here? What are the newer medications doing to the outcome of the disease?
So, we have blockers and co-stimulation. We have medications that reduce IL-6. We have medications that reduce B cells and JAK inhibitors, and perhaps in the future, medications that will affect epigenetic changes. I think what's going to happen is we are going to try and figure out immunologically what is the best strategy to achieve drug-free remission if you treat early. So early diagnosis and early initial, some say aggressive, I would say optimal treatment to get people into a great state, i.e. remission by even 6 months, if not a year, and then trying drug-free remission. Or at least mostly drug-free remission. I think that is the way of the future. My suspicion is that all of our medications could help achieve that, but it's quite possible using a approach, we'll call it higher up in the immunologic food chain. In other words, where the disease is being driven will be more effective in getting people into drug-free remission down the line. And so the AVERT study, which was a study we would never do in practice, but nonetheless showed some interesting results. We took patients, they got methotrexate, they got abatacept, some were on steroids, they were treated for a year, everyone in low disease activity had all drugs stopped within a month, and the only people that were able to successfully remain drug-free, first of all, were the ABA plus methotrexate combo, and I have some reasons for that. Secondly, if you were caught within 3 months, your chance of being drug-free 18 months later was 30%, which is higher than we've ever seen.
This drug-free concept obviously is important, not only for the patient's life and the cost, but also the ability to stop a drug that has potential side effects.
Exactly.
What about in the setting of anti-TNFs? Similar concept, early approach, possible ability to get you off of all medicines?
So we haven't done that same study with the TNFs. We have seen, though, that if you take early disease, add a TNF plus methotrexate, and at a year, if you've been in remission, you can drop the dose. You can even, in many people, leave the methotrexate and take the TNF away. You can't stop everything. Only 40% of people can stop a TNF inhibitor completely, but about 60 to 80% can drop the dose. So that's already a cost savings, probably a risk savings, although people are still concerned that they have to maintain a biologic like TNF.
What role, finally, do you think that the biosimilars will play in this $40 to $50 billion industry?
Well, I mean, obviously they will be, the biosimilars will trump the generic or the regular medications. However, our regular medications will become biosimilars. So they'll just drop the price, they'll stop marketing it. It's sort of like Abbott making Synthroid as a L-thyroxine. They're just going to come right there in with it. So as long as they're truly biosimilar, it doesn't matter. From a cost perspective and the patient's perspective, I worry about two things. I don't think we should be interchanging biosimilars. I think our chance of immunogenicity and confusing what's going on, because if patients flare between them, we won't know. So I don't have a problem with biosimilar. Pick one, keep on the same one.
At the beginning, at the onset of care.
Right.
But don't change.
You know, whatever you start, you continue.
Do you think the insurance companies will mandate it because it costs less?
They'll mandate what costs less. So it doesn't matter if it's biosimilar. We already see that there are deals being made with pharma and the payers. So some payers have made a deal with one company, other payers have made a deal with a different company, and I don't even talk to a patient yet about which one I'm going to start, because I don't know yet what insurance company they have and which drug they're going to tell me to use. Is it going to be adalimumab? Is it going to be etanercept? Is it going to be certolizumab? They're all different. Every insurance company will let me start a different one. And quite frankly, I don't care. They all work.
If you push to target.
Yes.
That's the key.
That is the key.
Great. Well, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful discussion. And thank you for coming into Conversation with Experts.